It's a pleasure today to welcome our speaker, Richard Anderson. Richard is James Boswell Professor of Neuroscience in the Division of Biology at California Institute of Technology. He did his PhD at UCSF with Mike Bursnick, and then moved on from there to do a postdoctoral fellowship with Vernon Mountcastle at Johns Hopkins. After positions at the Salk, at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he moved to the California Institute of Technology to cover all the bases, where he's been since 1994. And I would say his career was focused by his postdoctoral fellowship with Vernon Mountcastle, where he investigated the parietal cortex and made a salient observation, a number of salient observations, but among them, the observation of gain fields in parietal cortex, namely cells that responded to a visual stimulus quite well, but the gain of their response changed with the position of the eye in the orbit. He went on to investigate this phenomena and also multiple areas in parietal cortex to show how the visual information in these areas and other sensory information is transformed into not only the control of the eye to shift gaze from one place to another, but to control arm movements and the coordination between these. This work has been widely recognized. He's certainly the leader in the field of studying how the parietal cortex converts sensory input to movement. And he's been widely recognized by election to the National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's going to extend this work today from parietal cortex to include frontal cortex. And his title, as you can see, is Free Choice Activates Decision Circuits. Richard, it's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you, Bob, for the very nice introduction and for inviting me here. It's great to be back at NIH and to see a lot of old friends and catch up on what they're doing. Today, as he mentioned, I'll be talking about some experiments that we've been doing on decision making. And in particular, we use a task which allows the monkey to choose. So there's nothing instructed about it. He's free to choose. And we use that kind of paradigm to examine aspects of decision making in both the frontal and in the parietal cortex. Now, in terms of people working on these experiments, these are different days in our lab. My assistant somehow is able to get all these scientists to dress up on occasional Fridays and different themes. So you can see this was a sort of California theme here, well-dressed up theme, stripes, red, fancy shoes. This one is Hawaii Day, cold twins, and, of course, alma maters. The people that worked on the particular experiments that I'll be talking about today are Chess Stetson, who actually is from Texas, so he fits the part. Also, He Shui, who just got a job at the Medical College of Georgia. Bijan Pesaran, who's now an assistant professor at NYU. This is Marcus Hochschild. He's a USC graduate student, but working in our lab. And Unjung Wang, who's a postdoctoral fellow. Now, in the talk today, I'll address three specific questions. The first is, does parietal cortex activity indicate the outcome of a decision? The second is, are there instances where there are separate stages for decision-making and planning within the parietal cortex? And the third is, what are the neural dynamics of decision-making between frontal and parietal cortex? And after I cover these three questions, if there's time, I'll show some examples of decoding plans out of parietal cortex for neuroprosthetic applications. In this case, it'll be some new things that we've done in just the last few months. So this is taken from a review by Michael Platt, and it shows the different parts of the brain that are involved in decision and reward for making eye movements. And you can see that it's very complicated and involves a very distributed set of locations throughout the brain. Now, the parietal cortex, that aspect having to do with eye movements, is LIP located here. And there, it's been found to play a variety of roles. The Mickey Goldberg's lab is concentrated on attention. Paul Glemsher and Bill Newsom, among others, on its role in decision making and evaluation of reward. And we've worked on its activity related to movement planning. So the question I'll address first is posterior parietal cortex activity indicative of the outcome of a decision? That would be much like a plan. And early on, we proposed that the parietal cortex is involved in planning by an experiment in which we used what we call effector choice. So the monkey, an effector task. In this case, it was instructed. And the monkey was instructed by the color of a target whether to plan a saccade or to plan a reach. So a green target indicates to plan a reach, a red to plan an eye movement. And during a delay period, we reasoned that if the monkey was planning different movements and there was different activity in this epoch, then it was related not to general properties of attention to that location or arousal, but rather to the plan to make a particular movement. And what we found was that in LIP, the cells during that delay period were active when the monkey planned a saccade but not a reach to the same region. And in the what we call the parietal reach region, they were active in this delay period when the monkey was planning a reach but not a saccade. So this represented a double dissociation. And so we propose that within the parietal cortex, there is an anatomical segregation for planning, one in LIP that's important for planning eye movements, and one in the parietal reach region that's important for planning reaches. Now, a recent experiment by Assad and Freeman, though, present an alternative interpretation that we wanted to address. And that, again, would stipulate that LIP is important for, or the parietal cortex, for a sensory function. But in this case, it would be attaching meaning to the stimulus. So what they did in their experiment is, in a recording from LIP, they trained the monkey in a categorization task. So the monkey learned to, if movements were in a particular direction within a category boundary here, so say the movement's like this, it would be up in this red category, then the monkey responds to which, with a hand movement, which category it belongs to. And what they found was that during this task, the LIP neurons, these are for all the different directions in red and blue, categorized in terms of their activity which set the sample belonged to. So in our task, then, you can imagine that since we use these cues, the monkey could be interpreting one cue, the red cue, as having the meaning of making an action of a saccade without actually forming a plan to make a saccade, and the green cue could reflect the meaning to make a reach. And so, again, it would be sensory in nature instead of having activity related to planning. So to address this issue, we've trained monkeys, this is He Shui, to make these free choice tasks where the monkey is free to choose whether to make an eye movement or an arm movement. So in this case, the stimulus the monkey gets, here you'll see it's a red and a green LED next to each other is always the same. When it goes out, the monkey is free to choose either to make an eye movement or a reach movement to get a reward. So in this case, what's nice about this is you always have the same stimulus, so you don't have a different stimulus reflecting a different meaning, and it's only the choice of the animal that's important. Now, of course, though many of us here in the audience work with monkeys, and you know that given the choice, they will always make a saccade over reach. It's much easier. So we had to motivate the monkey to equally distribute his choices. And the way we do that is he plays a game with a computer. It's a like a rock, paper, scissors. And so the computer will, the monkey is rewarded if his choice matches the computer's choice. And what the computer does is bias the choice against the monkey's previous sequence of choices. So here you can see if the computer selects saccade and the monkey makes a reach, he won't get rewarded. However, if he does the saccade, then he is rewarded. And for the monkey to, in this game, perform optimally, he would have to obey what's called Nash's equilibrium, which basically means that he should randomize as much as he can his decisions and choose equally between making saccades and making reach movements. And you can see that the monkeys, in fact, do this. Here are for the two monkeys in the task. These are just sessions during a single day. This is the number of times the monkey chooses a reach, and this is the number of times he chooses a saccade. And you can see that these cumulative numbers lie along a 45-degree diagonal, indicating that the monkey is, in fact, choosing equally, and you can see that it doesn't deviate much from that line, indicating that he's more or less randomizing his choices. So that was fine, we can do that, but then we also want to have a set point at which the monkey makes the decision. So we don't want him, for instance, to make his decision here that I'm going to reach even before the trial begins. So what we do is we, on only half of the trials is he allowed to decide. That happens when there's the light that indicates the location for the action goes out. Then he knows after 6/10 of a second the light he's pressing will go out, and then he makes his choice. But in a quarter of the trials, one of the lights stays on. If it's red, he's instructed to make a saccade. And in another quarter, again, randomly in interleaved of the trials, a green light remains, and then after 6/10 of a second, he makes a reach. Oops. So what this does is it discourages the monkey from having a pre-selection bias, because up until this point, he doesn't know whether he's going to get to choose or if he's going to be instructed. So here's an example then of a LIP neuron. This is the activity when the cue appears here. Now, this is the activity when he's asked to make a choice. So both stimuli go off. And you can see these are histograms when the monkey chose the saccade versus when he chose to reach. And so you can see they separate here. And this is the go signal to make the movement. So you can see that the cell remained active if he was planning a reach, but went back to baseline if he planned, a saccade, but went back to baseline if he was planning a reach. And this is an example of a parietal reach region neuron. Once the instruction is given, once he's told he can freely choose, you can see the opposite pattern where the activity is higher when he's planning a reach, goes back when he plans a saccade. And these are the group data from the two monkeys. And what you can see here, here's LIP. When the monkey, if you compare it to baseline, the activity for choosing a saccade, it's highly significant compared to baseline. And when he's choosing a reach, it's highly significant. However, if he's choosing the non-preferred action, in both cases, it's not different from baseline. So it actually is not active at all if it's the non-preferred choice, non-preferred effector. So to conclude this part, if you see strong LIP activity and weak reach region activity, the monkey's planning a saccade. The reverse is true if he's planning a reach. And so then we can say, is the monkey coding in LIP and PRR by the meaning of the stimulus? And since the stimulus is always the same, there's not a different kind of stimulus asking for a different effector response, we can rule this out. And so this means that LIP and PRR neurons fire stronger when there's a saccade, in which case it's LIP, or a reach, in which case it's the reach region. So in terms of question one, does the parietal reach region activity indicate the outcome of the decision process? We can say yes. And in the absence of an instruction specifying effectors, the posterior parietal cortex still shows effector specificity for freely chosen saccades and reaches, with LIP preferring saccades and the reach region preferring reaches. And this means that the posterior parietal cortex not only passively, doesn't only passively transform sensory stimuli to behaviorally relevant representations, but also plays an active role in plan selection and movement preparation. Okay, now the second question is, are there neural correlates for decision-making that at times are separate from those for planning? And usually if you look at a psychology book, you'll see that as you go from sensory processing to motor output, that you have in between a decision box where the decisions are made and a separate box where the planning takes place. And many neurophysiology experiments have suggested that actually the decision and planning may take place at the same location. So this is just an example taken from one paper from Shadlin and Newsom, where they've combined in parietal and frontal areas, including our friend LIP here, both the decision and planning stage, so that there is no separate stage. So next I'll show you some recordings from another part of the parietal cortex. This is area 5, or dorsal area 5. It's located up here in the parietal lobe up on the surface. And if you recall, during the activity for the planned, for activity in PRR, you had this separation that occurred. So first, you had activity when the monkey wasn't sure whether he was going to be instructed to make an I or an R movement. You had very robust activity at that time. And so that may represent a default plan. In a sense, in both when he's first given the target, he forms a plan in both LIP for a saccade and in the reach region for a reach. But once he's allowed to choose, then he specifies one and the other one disappears. So in this case, the activity increases in the reach region. So that would be choosing the reach. This shows a typical cell in area 5, and what you see is that there's no default plan activity. And once he's allowed to choose, you see that there is a separation like we see in the reach region for this neuron, but it occurs much later than what you see in the reach region. And this is just showing population response from the one monkey we've recorded from so far. And you can see in general this behavior where there's no default plan, only activity after the choice. And also if we look at the latency difference at which the separation forms, and the monkey makes a choice. In PRR, it's around 250 milliseconds at which the separation occurs, whereas in Area 5, it's up around 370 milliseconds. So what these data suggest is that, at least in, for these two areas, the decision process is separate from the planning process for this particular task. So you have sensory inputs coming into the LIP and parietal reach region, and it represents both potential and selected plans. And then at the level of Area 5, it represents only the plan that has been selected. So here would be an area that may be the location for making the decision or deciding the action, and then this leads to the area that reflects the decision. So for question two, are there instances where there are separate stages for decision-making and planning in the parietal cortex? Again, the answer is yes. In contrast to the presence of activity related to potential plans in LIP and the reach regions, cells in Area 5 only fired when the effector was unambiguously specified to be the arm. The absence of activity related to potential plans in Area 5 suggests that a distinct neural correlate of motor preparation downstream from the plan selection. Okay, the third question has to do with now the dynamics of activity during decision-making between the frontal lobe and the parietal cortex. And usually we think of information flow passing through the cortex as being relatively feed-forward. So you have information from the visual cortex going into parietal areas and from there to the frontal lobe to execute the movement. But, of course, we all know from our anatomy training and also actually a great deal of interest in a number of labs like Bob's lab and others recently that there's a great deal, and in attention literature for top-down processing, that there's a great deal of processing that's flowing backward in the system as well. And, in fact, this can be transported via reciprocal cortical-cortical connections, which exist between for-all connections within the cortex. Now, I've been showing you in the reach region, usually we do a simple center-out task, so the monkey is reaching in different directions, and you get this sort of tuning curve for with each cell preferring a particular direction of movement. And if you think then if the monkey is doing a free choice, he's selecting a particular planned movement against a set of other plans. But also, if he's choosing that movement, now if it's just a stimulus appearing in the world, you could imagine that would sort of synchronize all these areas to plan in that particular location. But if he's free to choose the plan, how is it that all these areas come up with the same plan? So they must all in some way select or work together to plan a movement in a particular direction. It would be quite a mess if the frontal lobe was saying planning a movement one way and parietal or other areas were planning it in a different direction. So one avenue for this communication would be through reciprocal connections between these various areas that show tuning for parameters of a reach. So in the experiments, we examined two likely suspects, the parietal reach region and an area which it connects strongly to the dorsal premotor cortex. It, in turn, then projects to motor cortex, so it's very close to the motor output. And in these experiments, we recorded simultaneously from both regions. And this shows the task that we used. We wanted a task that was like a bit like a visual search task, but for reaching. And so the monkey is given on different trials an array of targets in different positions, and one of the targets has been baited. So, and of course that occurs randomly as well. So what he does is he just searches through the display until he finds the one that's been baited. You can hear from the change in the tone the one that gives him a reward, and then he stops. Now, you see this little light here. That's not actually on the screen. That's where he's looking. And so we've added that on by recording the eye position and adding it to the video just for demonstration purposes afterwards. But it does emphasize that these experiments are being done without fixation constraints. So this is what we think is a very natural sort of foraging behavior for the monkey. And Barry was talking to me just not too long ago about some of the tasks he's using in which the monkey picks something up quickly. This particular task is very easy for the monkey to do. He picks it up in a matter of a couple of weeks. Now, what we do is, so you can see that what happens is the array comes, first he presses on the central location, then an array comes on, and the central location stays on, so he withholds making any movements. Then when it goes out, he reaches to a target. That target goes out, and then he reaches to the next one, and so on until he gets the baited reward. And what we'll be looking at in the data is just this first selected target here. So it'll be the activity here when the array first comes on, but before he's made his first movement. And on trial to trial, he gets in a random order either circles, which indicate he's free to choose where to reach, or he gets targets with shapes. So in this, so here he has to, if there are three shapes, he has to reach the circle, the square, and the triangle. And the data I'll show you are from conditions where he was using only three targets. Now, the first thing that was a bit of a surprise for us was that in this task, for both the free choice and the instructed condition, the parietal activity occurred before, I'm sorry, the frontal lobe activity occurred before the parietal activity. And this was unusual, so we went back and did a lot of center-out experiments because we hadn't seen these really long reaction times or activation times before in the reach region. In the center-out task, we got down to the more typical activation times, but even there, they were on average equivalent within the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe. So this is a little different from the direction of the flow of information that we normally think about, suggesting that a lot of activity, a massive activity, potentially is occurring here first, possibly going back to the parietal lobe and influencing it. One way to look at potential communication cortico-cortically was to do spike field coherence. So basically what you do is you measure spikes in one area and look at its phase coherence with the LFP in another region. And you can do that for spikes in parietal, LFP recorded in frontal, and using the same electrodes, the spikes in the frontal with the LFP in the parietal. And, of course, you know that when we record the spikes, this is taken from a recording from the LIP, but the same is true for these other areas. You have these oscillations of the local field as well as with the spiking activity. And one potentially helpful interpretation that can be made is, since we tend to record from large cells and the areas we're recording from have many more output neurons than interneurons, that when we record spikes, we are biasing spikes toward outputs. However, when we're recording local fields are coming primarily from presynaptic synaptic potentials, And so they represent either inputs to the area or local processing within the area. So when we do the spike field coherence, spikes that cohere with local fields, it suggests that the spikes here are predicting local fields in this area and the possibility that the spikes if you have an increase in this coherence, represents greater communication between those two cortical areas. So that we then looked at coherence between local fields, and this would be an example of low coherence and high coherence, and its changes during these tasks. So this shows the spike field coherence in the 15 hertz band. In this case, the solid line, this is time in the task, this is when the array appears. And the solid line is looking at spikes in the frontal and coherence with local fields in parietal. And the dotted is spikes in parietal with local field in the frontal. And what you can see is at the beginning of the trial, there's an increase in coherence, and that the coherence increase begins first in the frontal to parietal direction. And then there's a handshake back with increased coherence after 30 milliseconds or so in the opposite direction. Now this, this is all done for the free choice here. We can also look at the condition where the monkey's instructed where to go. And we see in this condition, these are in red, that for the even in the instructed cases, this is the frontal leading the parietal and the reverse later handshake from parietal to frontal. So we see in those trials the same dynamics. And very noticeably, you see that there's much more coherence when the monkey is making a decision on his own compared to when he's instructed to do the movement. What we also did was we used the ROC analysis to see when we could predict from the activity from the spikes recorded in these two areas where the monkey was going to reach to his first target. And we separated that by significant spike field coherence between the areas versus those cells that did not show spike field coherence. So about 25%, about a quarter of the cells showed significant spike field coherence between the two areas. So it's a subset of the population. And the cells that showed this spike field coherence, which are the ones indicated in dark here, this is frontal spiking and parietal spiking, in both cases, they were the first to show the decision. And then the cells that didn't show the coherence followed with the decision. So this implies that there may be a special network of cells connecting frontal and parietal cortex that coordinate decision making. So in terms of question three, what can we say about neural dynamics of decision making? Well, the spiking appears first in the decision task and in the instructed task in the frontal cortex before parietal. Spike field coherence appears first from parietal to, from frontal to parietal in direction, followed by a handshake in the other direction. This suggests a more complicated path than the usual hierarchy of information processing we think about. That is, there seems to be large parietal to frontal activation and then a stream of information flowing back again to frontal from parietal. There's stronger coherence between frontal and parietal during the free choice compared to the instructed task. And it appears only a subset of cells that show coherence are the ones that first code the decision. So this suggests a subcircuit that coordinates planning between the two cortical areas. Okay, so the last little bit, I was will talk about now the idea of using the parietal cortex as a neural prosthetic for paralyzed people. And a reason for, well, one reason for doing it is we spent a lot of time recording there, and it seemed like an interesting place to look. But from a, I think, a more useful and intellectual point of view, well, motor cortex is a good place to go. It's the output, after all, so it would be a good source, and most groups have concentrated on that location. We thought, however, that it'd be interesting to see if you went step back from the motor output, where you have largely execution signals, to areas that are involved in planning and decision-making and all these other kinds of high-level cognitive functions, that you could read those cognitive functions out as well. And in many sorts of tasks, you could imagine where knowing the more abstract or cognitive intent of the subject would help in doing the decoding for operating a machine for a paralyzed person. One example is in motor cortex, it tends to be programming the movement of muscles, and in a sense then is velocity encoding a trajectory. So if you think about using that for communication, you would actually have to, in a sense, like a mouse, drag something to a location to, say, use a spelling board to spell something out. In the parietal lobe, we found that you can decode the intended goal, and you could do it extremely fast, within about 50 milliseconds or so. So you could actually imagine then that you could type instead of having to drag and click with a mouse. And so there, I think, a number of interesting features there. We also found in the parietal lobe recently that we can decode trajectories as well. Although this trajectory signal occurs on or about the time of the movement when the monkey's actually moving. So we think it really represents a forward model or an estimate of where the arm is going. However, we can also read it out with the monkey not making a movement. He can generate this forward model signal. So we can also recover trajectories from this region. Now, this just shows the basic idea behind the prosthetic, which is that if somebody is paralyzed, so they normally bring in visual information, plan movements, and send them out to the spinal cord. Lesion of the spinal cord would interrupt this, so you'd make an implant of a chip in the parietal lobe, or also the same would go for the premotor cortex, and you could decode the and transmit the signal wirelessly to various output devices like robot limbs. You could stimulate the muscles, wheelchairs, or communication devices. And as I mentioned, we've done the goal decoding, but it's always only been in 2D and requiring the monkey to fixate. And we've also done trajectories, and in terms of decision parameters, we've been able to decode what the monkey expects to get, how much reward, how often, and even what type, whether it's going to be juice or water. So what I thought I'd do today is mention three recent experiments over the last year that extend these findings. One is that we wanted to extend the goal decode to allow the monkey freedom to move his eyes and to make it 3D and not to make it center out, but rather the monkey can go to, in this case, I'll show you an example where he can go to 27 different positions in the 3D workspace. So the monkey is looking through their on a screen here is a projection, and he has two shutters on his eye, and each frame is presented to one eye or the other. So this is a stereo image. And so you'll see training trials now where we collect some trials to train the algorithm, and then we go to brain control where he just moves the target around with his thought. And so what you'll see is he's got a here on his arm infrared sensors that are being tracked with an OptiTrack device in 3D space. So he's moving his hand to touch these balls that only he sees in this virtual reality setup. So each time he moves to a location in space, he's getting a drop of juice. You can see him drinking that here. And you can see that it's not a center-out task at all. He's just going to a sequence of locations in that space. And while he's doing that, we're collecting data from the parietal reach region, which will be used for constructing the algorithm for decoding the monkey's movements when he's doing this in brain control. And this is what he sees. He sees a ball that he controls. It's the silver one here, and he's reaching to, in this case, this is under brain control, so he's moving the ball in 3D space with his neural signals to touch these locations. Now, what is, I think, amazing about this particular task, and you're seeing that here, is that he's not actually, in this case, using data from his sort of kinematically free movements, but actually it's been modeled on an actual robot limb. So it's running a simulation of a robot limb, which is shown here in our lab. And so what this means is what happened is in the robot limb, its motors saturate quickly and it's a lot slower. So it's like low-pass filtering the actual movement. So when he was moving his hand, things happened quickly. When he went to brain control, the ball was moving very slowly and sluggishly. So what he was doing was, in the first part of the day, shooting far past the ball and then learning within a day to learn an internal model of this limb he was controlling. Now, he doesn't actually see the limb. He just still sees those two balls. But we're sitting out there with this monitor, with this virtual reality recreation of the limb. And actually, there was a real limb, too, and it was being controlled via the internet to a fancy limb actually out here at the Applied Physics Lab here in Maryland. Now, the reason we did that was not to be cool. It was actually because they wouldn't let us have the limb. here it's only operating at 3 degrees, but they've made it now so it's 22 or so degrees of freedom, so it's a very expensive thing, and they didn't trust our monkey with it. But you can see that the monkey, in a day, learns the internal dynamics of this robotic limb using these neural control signals. And what's nice about this, too, is you can kind of get a sense, you couldn't really on the other slide, of where it's actually moving in 3D. So there, since it was projected on 2D, it doesn't look as impressive as when you can actually see it move out in three dimensions. Another thing we've done is symbolic decode. So you can imagine that if you, everything that's been done so far in the prosthetic world has been based on a goal, a target that you can see. But of course, say if you come to a stoplight, you press your brake, and then when it turns green, you don't reach out for the stoplight. You actually just put your foot on the accelerator. So in a sense, a lot of our motor movements aren't toward goals necessarily, and they're more symbolic in nature. So what Eunjung Wang did was train the monkey so he would press a little button, a little location on the screen when it illuminated and fixated the location. And then at the fixation location, a little arrow would appear. And in that case, the monkey would think to move the target to the direction of the arrow. And so he's thinking about reaching over here. And then if he does it correctly, he gets feedback about where he was thinking about reaching and gets a drop of juice reward. And so here's the some of the trials. And the little beep indicates he's getting a reward. And you can see that he does this quite easily. So he's taking this symbolic cue and he's translating it to locating an object in space. And so this indicates that this kind of prosthetic device is abstract enough that it could be used in a much larger variety of situations. This goes on for a very long time. This is the setup familiar to many of you, just minus Eun-Jung, who would normally sit here. So you can see the display you just saw running here, eye movement tracking, the monkey on the camera here, the recording from the different channels, and the control display. Now, we also have been interested in using local field potentials for the prosthetic applications, and we found an interesting one recently. Again, just to remind you that the spikes tend to be outputs that we record, and local fields inputs and intracortical processing. And again, the direction of processing we usually think of as visual to parietal to motor, so we see, make plans, and execute movements. That's, I realize, extremely oversimplistic. And then there are these back projections that exist here. So the spikes that we're recording, if we're making a prosthetic for the parietal lobe, may be sending signals to execution areas, and the local fields, at least a component of them, could be signals coming back from motor cortex. So the field potentials may provide an execution signal because the problem is we always worried that we'd be recording only planning from the parietal lobe but not the execution signal. But we may be able to recover it from the local field that we record in the parietal cortex. And so what Eun-Jung did is exactly that. She trained the monkey to control the local field in the parietal cortex without making a movement to generate an execution signal. And this shows the task here. The monkey sees, well, this is the usual task, the center out reach, gets a target, a delay, and then makes a reach. This is the spectrum of a recording at a single location, a single electrode. Before the when the target comes on, you can see, and during the delay in particular, there is a great deal of gamma band activity and a fall off of the lower field alpha, and then in the when the monkey, just before he plans to reach, the gamma band goes away and the lower band comes in. So there's a very dramatic change in the local field in the course of this sequence of the trial. So what she did was, if you look through, if you take selected bands, so here's one band here at the lower and one at the higher, you can see this during the delay increase and then decrease, and an increase in the lower band around the time of the movement. So she would take the difference of the two and differentiate them and get a whopping go signal prior to the movement. And so then the task she did was to make it self-paced. So what the monkey has to do, if he makes a movement right away with his brain control signal, then he doesn't get rewarded. So he has to wait from about, I think it's 1 3/4 to 3 3/4 second, and in that window generate the go signal. And so that's just shown here that he's cued a location and it's self-paced, so then he has to, after over a second, then generate the go signal to get feedback and reward. And so this just shows three examples. They've been slowed down by five times. But you can, this is the thresholding, this is the threshold here. So here is the target comes, the location comes on, the target, this fixation, the target, and then his self-paced initiation of the reach. And that's done without actually making a reach. This is in brain control. So here's an example of another trial. He reaches out to the fixation target, then the target appears, and again, he then generates this go signal, but without moving his arm. And this is just another example, third trial. And we find that the monkey learns this very quickly. This is the chance in this particular condition is around 20%. And you can see these are trials in the first day, and here's the second day. And by the third day, he's doing this nearly perfect performance. So to conclude this last part, we've shown that in for a cognitive-based neural prosthetic, intended reach goals in 3D space, abstract goals, and go signals can be read out and used as control signals for brain-machine interfaces. The 3D goal and go signals can be used to control computers, robots, and vehicles, of course. And abstract or symbolic decodes, we think, can greatly increase the range of applications by not requiring explicit targets. So thank you very much.
We have time for questions.
I have two related questions. I was puzzled by the fact that you have greater coherence for self-will decision making versus the scope of decision. And I wonder if you have some thoughts about why that would be. And then a related question.
Yeah, those are both very good questions. In terms of the last question, we're doing that experiment now to see if we get this increased coherence between, say, LIP and frontal eye field for eye movements is greater than reaching and vice versa for the connection between parietal and premotor. In terms of what the increased coherence means during the decision process, we've had a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, one obvious possibility is that attention could play a role, but we found that, maybe I have it here, that in the free search and instructed cases, these are, you typically see that the, as you go to the first, second, and third targets, this is a well-known phenomenon, the reaction times in the sequence go down, but you can see it's not really different between the free choice and instructed. So that's at least suggestive that it's about the same attention load. And another argument would be difficulty, but it, they, again, performed at the same rate. So one possibility, but again, it's just speculation, is that it represents greater deliberation during the decision task. And ideally, if we had some task where we could increase the deliberation time, we should also see that this increased coherence would also stretch out. But that's something for future experiments. Oh, yeah, we did. I didn't show it, and the reason is because it more or less reproduces what we had done before with the instructed conditions. Also, there's a caveat there in that the instructed conditions, compared to earlier experiments, the lights were always on, and also the monkey was always being rewarded in the instructed conditions because he was always getting it right, where it's only being rewarded 50% of the time in the decision task. So we also couldn't really fairly compare them because of the different reward contingencies within that experiment. But in broad strokes, the results were the same as we originally found with the instructed experiments. Right. Yeah. So I recall. Yeah, your work on that. And right, it was funnel eye field, parietal, and then supplementary eye field. Is that right? Oh, came first. Oh, okay. Then funnel eye field, and then parietal. Yeah. So I guess the question is, what are the homologs in the reach domain? I would think of. Well, it's hard to say. Maybe motor cortex is like funnel eye field. And premotor, but that's just speculating. But you're right, this does fit well with your results as well, in the sense of between frontal and parietal. Yeah, we have dissociated them, and we didn't see any real significant difference. we saw some cases where the activity went up and there was greater coherence, and other cases where it even go down and there was greater coherence. The technique for calculating the coherence takes into account the firing rates as well, so it's it normalizes for them. To begin the task, he touched a target, and then the array appeared, and then that location went off, and then he began. So he always started from the same initial position. Yeah. So it suggests that although we haven't separated or done this ROC, to see if one, it's suggestive of that, yeah. But I would say that this is a circuit, and so we're watching the dynamics, excuse me, within the circuit. So this data does suggest that the initial decision, we haven't really nailed this down, is being formed in the frontal lobe, going to parietal, and then back. So it's actually a loop. And from looking at the other data from earlier in the earlier work, we see that there is this plan activity that appears in the parietal. So that could be, how it's formed in those free decision tasks. Now, what I showed in the first experiments were that they had what looked like potential plans, and then in the reach region, then going to the one plan disappearing and only the single plan remaining. And in area 5, we saw only the eventually selected outcome. So we're thinking of doing the same experiment in premotor cortex now. And my guess is that we'll see what we saw in parietal reach region, which is we'll see, and say we could do that in frontal eye field, that we'll see both default plans. And then once the monkey is allowed to choose, we'll see just the one that he's going to actually make. So I think it'll actually look a lot like parietal, and that there is this decision circuit operating between the two. That That would be my guess. Actually, we have begun those experiments, and it is in this effector choice task. A nice feature of that is you don't have this flash of lights coming on. You just have one disappearing or remaining. And in that condition, too, we do see, so this, and it's nice, actually, it confirms that we see the frontal leading the parietal and spiking. And we also see this greater coherence in the decision versus instructed. So that's nice because in a very different kind of task where you're choosing effectors rather than positions in space, we are still seeing the same basic pattern.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thanks.